Looking for your next favorite podcast? Start here.
These guidelines were made across the world. There were some countries that didn't pay attention to them. So those are the countries now that have the lowest rates of food allergy.
Denmark was one, right?
Denmark,
yeah.
Norway.
Okay, so one time I was eating strawberries out of a bowl, cut up whatever juice was in them. So obviously, like, I had strawberry on my hand. And afterwards, and my dog wanted some so bad, but I was hungry and I didn't want to give my dog any. So afterwards, I let him lick my hand and then I went and washed my hands afterwards. If that isn't true love, I don't know what is. And that's why I love dogs, because I feel like I'll do anything for them. Like, I will literally let them lick my hand clean because I just want to be there for them.
In the hotel industry, you see discussion of, you know, everything from bed bugs to overdue maintenance to even sex trafficking.
Today, hear samples from After On, Stupid Genius, and Here Cincinnati. Welcome to Start Here from Cincinnati Public Radio. I'm Trip Eldridge, your podcast jockey. Each week, we sample and highlight three podcasts to help you navigate the exploding podcast world and maybe find your next podcast obsession. Plus, get an email summary of each podcast we feature with our weekly Start Here email blast. Just go to wvxu.org/subscribe and select the Start Here blast email at the bottom of the page. And if you like what you hear, please rate us at Apple Podcasts. A 5-star rating will help others find us in the iTunes gallery. With special thanks to Cincinnati Public Radio's Wiser Advisors, Jim Nolan and Kevin Reynolds, and writing, research, and curation support from Connor Eldridge, let's start here. With AI and other life-altering technologies progressing exponentially, it's easy to get overwhelmed by the prospect of the future. In an increasingly online world, what does privacy look like? Where does the line between artificial intelligence and sentience get drawn? All these questions, social issues, and more are explored in After On. It's a podcast about the future and based on the best-selling speculative fiction novel of the same name. After On gathers experts from many different scientific and behavioral fields for thoughtful, unhurried conversations about some of the issues and themes addressed in the book. We don't know what the future holds, but we can get the next best thing and listen to some of the smartest people's best guesses. Here's a sample from a recent episode of After On featuring scientist Kari Nudeau of Stanford. Dr. Nudeau is one of the world's leading immunologists focusing on the mysterious epidemic of food allergies. She joins the show in this clip to discuss the future of this affliction and why the number of people affected by food allergies has gone up several 100% in the past decades.
And so the last D, though, is diet. And that diversifying the diet is probably something we should be doing in infancy early on and often.
Yeah. Let's talk about this, because this was the self-inflicted thing that probably has a lot to do with the surge in the 2000s. We talk about some of the national guidelines that started spreading on this topic.
When I was getting trained as a postdoc plus a clinical fellow, we were all getting taught avoid, avoid, avoid. This is some kind of epidemic. It's coming up since the 40s, the 70s, the 90s. And so what's going on here? Why are we seeing this increase in food allergies? And people were puzzled. People saw that people were anaphylaxing. Not any infants or toddlers, but still it was happening in childhood. People were getting exposed in school. And so people got together in guidelines, very well-meaning, very well-trained physicians and scientists, to be able to get together guidelines to say, how do we stop this seeming epidemic?
Yeah, well, it was the tip of the iceberg at that point from what
right.
you said. And they put the iceberg in the freezer rather than in the microwave, it sounds like. So what happened? What were these guidelines?
So the guidelines said delay the introduction of foods like peanut, egg, milk, as well as shrimp.
Delay it to children,
to
newborns.
2 to 3 years of age, that's right. Don't feed it to your children until they're 2 or 3 years of age.
With the logic being that the immune system is better formed by that time and they'll be readier for it? Or was
Perhaps,
this just
exactly.
a guess? Like, how in the world did this happen, right? There hadn't been any double-blind study or anything like this, but these literally did become national guidelines that responsible parents or obsessive parents, maybe even more responsible than responsible, would look up and say, oh, wow, okay, no peanut, egg, walnut for my child until they're, what, 3?
That's right. International guidelines then became available in most countries to say delay, delay, delay.
And consensus formed on this. And these guidelines are not easily passed. So overwhelming consensus formed. And again, I'm sorry to be harping on this, but there was no data. This was just a hypothesis. Is that common? Somebody must have felt really sure.
So there was no randomized controlled trial. People were using this as a precautionary reflex, and I wasn't there, so it's hard for me.
You were still being taught at
that
point.
I think we thought that by not exposing those B cells, by not training them to make that IgE early, maybe you could just quiet them down. So that was kind of the going thought. It was also that if people did have any B cell that was starting to make IgE, that by not giving that food,
not feeding it,
you weren't going to continually expose it and get it revved up. But unfortunately, it was probably coming through the skin. So long story short, these guidelines were made across the world. There were some countries that didn't pay attention to them. So those are the countries now that have the lowest rates of food allergy.
Denmark was one, right?
Denmark,
yeah.
Norway. But nevertheless, so these guidelines were made. A whole food industry became arm in arm with these guidelines. You have many companies that started to write stage zero, stage one, stage two type food products.
There were foods that were being released and probably selling in the volumes of billions of dollars that were supporting this well-meaning but erroneous medical view.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And then to answer your question, how often does that happen? It probably happens more often than we would ever want.
Yeah.
That when you think about guidelines, when you think of HIV and HTLV and Robert Gallo and the French investigator that was studying AIDS, there 10 years went by before people actually said, this is the virus that causes HIV.
What's worse about this seems to be magnification. So you had said that one of the D's is diet, and we feel very high confidence now. The recommendation is expose them as early as possible, right? So we ended up doing the literal opposite of what we should have done. What it reminds me of, in a way, is the opioid epidemic on a different level, because there, on essentially zero data, this orthodoxy took root that pain was under-medicated and that opioid painkillers almost never caused addiction. So that idea got out there. And once it took root, that orthodoxy became extremely hard to expunge. And that stuck us with this vast problem of our own making. Now, the difference is the opiate story has some real villains who knew what was going on and were profiteering from that. I don't think there's any ringleader in this case.
No,
right?
There's no ringleader. It was kind of benign negligence that there wasn't really enough data to say anything otherwise. But then, come 2008, come some studies that were coming out of Australia in epidemiological evidence saying, well, wait a minute, the children that actually start to eat egg early, they're not getting the allergies. And there was another study in Israel where, wait a minute, the kids that are started eating milk early, they're not getting as many milk allergies. Same thing in Japan. They started publishing this data saying, wait a minute, guys, we might be wrong here.
And this is 2008, 2009.
2008, 2009, 2010. These studies start to come out of the international literature.
So the orthodoxy has been in place for about a decade or
exactly.
Something like that. Yeah.
Then 2011, some guidelines start to come out saying, well, wait a minute, you probably shouldn't delay.
Some national guidelines got withdrawn.
Exactly. 2011, they're starting to kind of say, well, wait a minute, we might be wrong. Then Gideon Lack is visiting Israel in an audience of Israeli physicians, and he says, please raise your hand if you are seeing a lot of peanut allergy in Israel. And he always asks this before he starts lecturing on peanut allergy, which is a problem in the United Kingdom. And so that's what he's lecturing on. No one raises their
hands. So he's walking the earth, and this is a standard opening thing.
Exactly.
And in his note cards, it says, look at forest of hands, say, yes, I'm not surprised. And to his astonishment, here he is in Israel and no hands going up.
Right. Because in the US, they would be up. In Australia, they would be up. But then Israel, very few people raise their hands at all.
A sample from After On with host and author Rob Reed. Take a deep dive into the world of tomorrow with After On. Available now on WVXU's Podcast Central. New to the Podcast Central collection is a great podcast for all you brainiacs out there. It's called Stupid Genius, and it's the brainchild of popular YouTuber Emma Chamberlain. Each episode, Emma takes on a puzzling question like, why do onions make us cry? She gets three guesses to get it right. Stupid Genius will test your aptitude for common knowledge, make you a little smarter, and hopefully make you laugh along the way. Have you ever wondered why humans are ticklish, or why some things make you sneeze and other things keep you from sneezing? Well, if you're looking for boring scientific research, look elsewhere. But if you want to have a good time while you learn, check out Stupid Genius for the right answer along with lots of wrong answers. Here's a snippet from a recent episode of Stupid Genius to taste test for you. The episode takes a stab at the question, why do dogs lick humans? Take a listen and find out the possible reasons behind our furry friend's sloppy signs of affection.
Okay, so let me try to think of another scenario here. Okay, mood. I found it. I found it in my brain. All of the files have been opened up and then they've been closed. We know where we're going with this. So the only real other time that I can remember getting that form of affection from a dog was when I had food on my face. Or on my hands. Or food basically anywhere. That sounds bad too. That sounds bad because every single middle school had that whole peanut butter rumor. But like, let me give you an example. Like, even if there's no food visibly on my face, dogs know. Okay, dogs can smell it. Like, if I had, what's like a food like that a dog would want to eat off my face? Like, if I had a peanut butter and jelly sandwich, okay? And like, peanut butter is something that lingers. Like, I feel like peanut butter is pungent. It's not a bad thing, but it's just the way it is. Like, if you make a peanut butter and jelly sandwich, your hand is going to smell like peanut butter for at least the next 20 minutes, minimum. I mean, seriously. Maybe the peanut butter. Okay, do you know what? Why are we going on a tangent about peanut butter? Nobody asked for that. All right, going back to what I was saying. Dogs smell it and they want what you have. So they try to lick it off of you. Are they going to succeed? Probably not. They're not going to get anything out of it, but they think that they will. And that's all it takes for a little lick from a dog. All right. And do you know what? I don't even mind because I would be completely lying to you if, okay. So one time I was eating strawberries out of a bowl, cut up whatever juice was in them. So obviously like I had strawberry on my hand and afterwards, and my dog wanted some so bad, but I was hungry and I didn't want to give my dog any. So afterwards I let him lick my hand and then I went and washed my hands afterwards. Like, if that isn't true love, I don't know what is. And that's why I love dogs, because I feel like I'll do anything for them. Like, I will literally let them lick my hand clean because I just want to be there for them. You know, and also because it's nice, because then, like, you know, I don't have to use as much soap and like scrubbing to get it off when I wash my hands afterward. Like, I need therapy. Okay, how was that one? Okay, at least my second one was right. Like, at least my second guess was right. All right, let's hear what the real answer is.
I'm Professor Flula, here with the stupid genius answer to why do dogs lick? There are actually several reasons, guys. The first is, it's a way of trying to show affection. When we pick up our doggies or give them attention, we typically pat or kiss their heads and pat their furs. They show affection back by licking us. However, they also use licking as a way of getting attention. This is usually a learned behavior because typically after a dog licks you, yes, it's true, you give them more attention. But they can also use licking as a sensory tool. So if they're licking random objects or areas of your house, they're probably just exploring. I'm Professor Flula Borg, and that was the stupid genius answer of the day.
Oh my God, T, this is such big T.
That was Stupid Genius from Ramble Media. You can be the smartest dumb person in the world alongside Emma on Stupid Genius. Available now on WVXU's Podcast Central. As usual, our third sample podcast and start here is a local podcast. And in the local spotlight today is Here Cincinnati, H-E-A-R, just like Start Here. It's from WCPO Television. On the show, journalists and reporters share their inside scoops on the city's biggest news stories. They cut through the attention-grabbing headlines and clickbait titles to get you to the real, get-to-the-point facts of every story. Here Cincinnati is the perfect way for you to stay in the loop on all the important issues and stories affecting our community. Host Brian Neese and his guests, some of Cincy's top journalists, will make sure you have all the latest on the news of the week. Here's a sample for you to check out. It's from Here Cincinnati's episode featuring the booming hotel industry in the city and the work that our Cincinnati health inspectors and city officials are doing to make sure hotels are safe and up to code.
The hotel industry is booming in Cincinnati, but what should cities do about properties under duress? A good friend of ours, investigative reporter Dan Monk, is here to explain that. Dan, welcome.
Thanks, Brian. Appreciate you having me.
Yeah, thanks for coming in. So you looked into the hotel industry in town here, and it's doing well.
It is.
How well is it doing?
Well, 5 straight years of increases. I think they've had a 32% increase in the okay. room rates. Occupancy rates are at an all-time high. Hmm. There's been like $128 million worth of properties that have changed hands since the start of 2017. And there's something like 1,300 new hotel rooms in the region.
Wow.
A lot of new hotels downtown. So, sure. Yeah, it's kind of a booming market.
Do you think that's due to the revitalization of the downtown over the Rhine area?
I think that's a factor, sure. And hospitality industry has been slowly recovering since the 2008 recession.
I see.
So that's happening almost everywhere.
Got it. And so some of it is because of the industry as a whole, and some right. of it is because of what's happening in Cincinnati.
People are spending more money on travel and leisure, entertainment, and things okay. like that. So, yes, I think the hotel industry nationwide is doing better. But in Cincinnati, you've got these added factors of, a rapidly developing central core area. Right. And in the northern suburbs, you still have these powerful magnets for tourism, the Kings Island area. And Sharonville has its own convention center that books, you know, weekend events all the time. So,
yeah, it does. I was just out there not too long ago for Whorehound. So one of the things that your story really focused on was Springdale. Mm-hmm. They have a hotel enforcement program.
Right.
What can you tell me about that?
Well, they started it in 2015 because they were seeing problems at some of the properties that are in Springdale. It's not a really big hotel town. I think they only right. have 5 open hotels right now.
Okay. You mentioned like magnets and stuff. Springdale doesn't really have a Kings Island or anything like that.
No, they do have some, you know, corporate communities, okay. and they've got retail, the Tri-County Mall area, somewhat of a regional destination, but they really don't have something like a Kings Island that's right. going to draw a couple million people in a year. And they don't have, you know, the overnight demand that other communities do. Right. So being off the beaten path, you're seeing properties that are kind of older and in some cases have deferred maintenance. In some cases, it's a very low-priced product, and that brings a certain kind of clientele, longer-term stays, a lot of extended-stay hotels there. And what they have seen in the past is that there are problems associated with that kind of hotel trade, including, in some cases, drug abuse on the properties. And in their quarterly meeting minutes, where they discuss the ongoing problems in the hotel industry, you see discussion of, you know, everything from bed bugs to overdue maintenance to even sex trafficking. Springdale police had a case in 2016 where they got a tip from a family member that a 16-year-old runaway was staying in that hotel. That led to charges against the guy who was in the room with her, and that person was later convicted on sex trafficking and producing child pornography. And a lot of it was based on, you know, what they found in that hotel room.
A local podcast feature, Hear Cincinnati, from Channel 9 WCPO. Join Brian each week and never miss a Cincy story again. You can listen to all the episodes now through WVXU's Podcast Center. As is our custom, we end Start Here each week with a look at what's bubbling up on the Apple Podcast charts via iTunescharts.net. Well, 2 notable podcasts just debuted and are working their way to the top of the charts. The first, The Oath with Chuck Rosenberg from MSNBC. The new podcast features one-on-one conversations with thoughtful former American public officials from the highest levels of government service, led by former U.S. attorney and FBI official Chuck Rosenberg. The other, The Daily Breath with Deepak Chopra. Deepak invites you to join him for a few short minutes each day to explore impactful ideas and themes that directly relate to all of our lives. He speaks of happiness, gratitude, love, sex, the true self, physical well-being, death, and more, and ends each podcast with a 10-minute meditation. Well, being mindful is chart-pleasing. He's climbed to number 2 on the Apple Podcast charts. Thank you for joining us for Start Here, Cincinnati Public Radio's Discovery Podcast. For more information about podcasts we like, check out Podcast Central at WVXU.org. And remember, if you've got a podcast or an episode you'd like to recommend, email us at podcast@WVXU.org or call us at 513-294-8030, and we'll add your voice to ours. For now, I'm Trip Eldridge for Cincinnati Public Radio, and thank you for choosing to start here.